honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Over the next month, you're going to hear so much about D-Day, Operation Overlord, and the invasion of Normandy as we approach the 75th anniversary of that day that changed the world. It certainly changed the life of a young Navy corpsman out of Brooklyn, New York, named Jack Gutman. Before the invasion, he had helped set up Navy Base Hospital 12 in England, and he was one of about 50 from that unit, Special Navy Advance Group 56, recruited to accompany troops ashore and handle casualties.
We got the call, our group, and as I said, we were under deep secrecy. They made up a lot of fake things, like for Calais. They made it look like Calais was going to be the landing place.
All the way down to, like, inflatable tanks and stuff
like
that. They
had inflatable tanks and sound effects and trucks. I mean, that was amazing. Now, I found this all out later, the messages they would get sending out. And it was brilliant. God bless Eisenhower and his staff, I mean, and what they did. Well, it turned out, they got us and they said, okay, you're not to go back to the base. We're loading up and stuff. And they put us on this APA. They had a lot of ships. We were going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've had apprehensions that it was going to be something big. What the Germans saw on the 6th when they, like, come up and all that, there were 5,000 ships, 4,500 landing craft. There was 11,000 planes of various sorts, and there was 150,000 men were going to hit five beaches. Ours was going to be Utah and Omaha. I was planned for Utah, as I thought, you know, but there was a lot of current, and we drifted. So I know we went off close to Omaha, between those two or near there, because the casualties were horrendous there. So what happened, the water was very choppy. We started coming down the nets, and we lost a couple guys that went off the ropes in between the LCVPs, that's the landing crafts, in between.
So you're just trying to get from the APA down to the LCVP, and guys are falling and drowning.
When you're climbing, as soon as you get down to where the boat is going up and down.
Sure.
I mean, huge waves. They get you on the up thing, and you got to jump in, and the guys catch you and bring you in the boat. Some guys let go too soon, and when it was on there, and they went in between the boat and the ship with the heavy packs on their back, they went straight down. They couldn't get the packs off enough time. And so we lost some men doing that. I mean, one was on the net that I was coming down, and I just couldn't believe that. I mean, that was my first shock.
Ugh.
I mean, I had thought of things that I was going to see, Paul. But as we came in and we get into the LCVPs and the water is very rough, and all of a sudden you see the cannons going off, I mean, from the ships, the shells.
Yeah.
When you're close enough where you can see as you know, you're going bivouacking around until your wave come in. First, second, third, fourth wave, those guys are the forces that go in. They caught it badly. My job is just to take care of the wounded. So we're like in a 14th wave or something like that, or I don't know. Because we're in to take care of the wounded. We're not in for the shooting or action. Carried a 45, no rifles. You carry medical pack 45. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the Pacific. When I see the shells hitting the beach, I said to myself, there isn't going to be a thing alive on that beach. It just won't be. When it came our time, when we went in, you hear planes going over and so forth. You figure, oh, well, this is it. I mean, it's going to be a cakewalk. They're going to drop all those bombs. Unfortunately, Paul, these bunkers, big German bunkers were up there where they could shoot down on their beaches. They had a machine gun, could shoot off 150 bullets a minute.
Yeah.
When they went to drop the bomb, it was cloud cover, and they could not see the beach of the bunkers. So they were told, which I found out, they were told, when you think you're near the beach, count three and drop the bombs, because they didn't want to hit the guys down there.
Yeah, not the allies coming in.
Right, allies. So what happened, all the bombs dropped on the other side about 2 miles in. It was almost by the time they dropped, the bombs hit. Nothing hit the bunkers. There was some shelling that the ships got that took care of some things there.
Yeah, you can still find those craters if you go there
right,
today.
Right, yeah. And then what happens, you got all of those guys that were coming in on the first, second, third, wherever, they just, some never got a shot off. Now, one of the problems was they had these big girders in the water and other obstacles. Let me clarify something. When you go in for an invasion, you're LCVP or your landing craft, you go right up to the beach and then the thing drops down and you run off onto the beach. That's the normal pattern. That's what you practice for. But the Germans had all of these barriers there, plus landmines and everything else. They had to stop. So we had to stop way out there and wade in water up to our chests. When the machine guns started going off on this thing here, the guys panicked. A lot of guys were seasick. They were throwing up over each other. It was a mess. But they leaped off the side of the boat instead of waiting for the ramp to go down. And the water was so deep there, with the heavy pack, if they couldn't get the pack off, they drowned. Mm. Never got a shot off. It was like a nightmare. Rommel had set up 35,000 mines on the beaches with the barbed wire. They were supposed to get these tanks that's supposed to come in and the demolition crews that makes the path so the guys can go right through. The water was so rough and they could not come all the way up to the beach, you see. They dropped the thing so the tank could roll off. So they had these devices where the tank would be on that were made special for them, a little motor in the back, and the tank would go up close to it. But when the water was so rough, it flipped the tank. The guys drowned right into the tank if they couldn't get out. We were talking about nightmares. That was one of the big nightmares that happened. Did not plan on it. It was a great idea, but that's what it was. So no big tanks hit so they could clear the beaches. So when I'm talking to anyone, I tell people, I said, if you watch Saving Private Ryan, the movie, they portrayed it the best that I've ever seen, but it was only like half of what it was because the only thing it did show, it was vivid and very accurate. But what they didn't show was all the body parts. And when I think of it, that's what got me. And then you got these guys on the beach wounded when you finally land on the beach. And guys are screaming, Mama, Mama. And then they look at you and then they say, Doc, am I going to live? And you have to lie to them because you know who's if they're going to die or not. And all, and it becomes like a nightmare. And you're in survival mode. And then you're always thinking in your mind, did I do the right thing? When I gave him that morphine shot to ease his pain and all, did I do enough? When I patched this up here, did it work okay? All these things spin in your mind, and all you're doing is going from one to the other. And then somebody says, well, you know, you're out in the open. What were some of the barriers? And that was like some of my nightmares that I went through in post-traumatic stress afterward. What you had to do sometime, if you had a guy and you had to drag him along to try to take care of him, you had another body that was dead, a American soldier, a kid. Excuse me. God keeps remembering me back. That you're using as a protection. It was like hell. I mean, hell.
So to try to save one injured soldier, you had to use a deceased American soldier as a shield.
Yeah, because there's not enough barriers there. Whatever girders or what you could hide behind or drag over there or dig in the sand or whatever you could, it was just horrible. And that was the way it was. I was on the beach the whole time. I think we were on about 6 or 7 hours, you know. But the bodies in the water floating around, I mean, guys laying around, it was just a horrible, horrible thing. And then what happened, I kept thinking, especially looking at the body parts, is that I thought quickly, could be like my brother or a friend. There's a father that'll never go home. There was a son that'd never go home. You see all this, and that all stays with you. Not at that time, it builds up in your head. And people constantly always said to me, because after that invasion was over, and I evacuated him, we got him back to the ships, and when we had enough, we took him back to the hospital that we had. So we were on the beach that time. Thank God we did it, and thank God for the men, the guys that died. And I remember people who used to say to me, have you ever gone over there to Normandy or any of these places? And I said, no, I didn't want to even face it because, see, the things that was happening to me after that invasion was, and Paula, my daughter, asked me once, when I was writing my book, what was your post-traumatic stress like? And I said, well, it's different with each person. It was just horrible. She said, well, don't you think your readers would like to know that? And I said, okay. So I finally sat down very reluctant about it because it was very traumatic for me. And when you're writing it, I mean, I'm crying because I'm visualizing all these things that happened. But what you see in my post-traumatic stress, I see the invasion. It'll happen some flashes. A lot of times when you're relaxing or going to sleep, especially sleeping, where you see the invasion over and over again, it keeps happening, but it's magnified. And you see the guy screaming, mama, mama, and the wounded, and you see the body parts. Everything's magnified. The shelling, everything is big. It's like a nightmare. And I remember the same thing happened. Like Normandy was one thing. Okinawa was another thing that was very devastating.
There's a fair amount of time between, and we're talking June of 44 to April of 45.
That's right.
And in between, you're in England at the hospital? At what point did you move to the Pacific?
What happened, I went after we evacuated the guys there.
Yeah.
And it turned out, by the way, in Normandy, we lost 9,000 men. Just a horrible thing. Well, I took care of them. I was at the hospital there for 2 months after the invasion, taking care of all the wounded there. Ironically, there was a guy that I patched up on the beach. He got shot here.
Right,
and there was a lot of blood, you know, and everything. And so I remember patching him up and giving him a shot. And he said, Doc, I'll tell you one thing. At least I'm going to go home, you know. And I said, yeah, you're going to make it home, you know. And he wound up in the hospital. Now, he was an officer. When I got back there, they sent me after the other thing. And I still couldn't tell the guys at my thing that where I had been. It was still all secret.
So the people who stayed behind at the hospital.
The guys there, even some of my buddies that I had, I just couldn't tell them. I said, let me know when. They said, we'll tell you. And I could not say anything because I figured court-martial. Even though it was over now. But we took care of him and we got the wounded. Now this officer, I wound up in officer's ward there, taking care of the wounded. He was there. And that's another thing that bothered me. Where he got shot, it sealed off so no blood was going down the leg and all. Mm. It sealed some artery or whatever it was there. And they had to amputate his leg just above the knee. So when I saw him there, I'll never forget his name. His name was Pat Prendeville. So we got to talking, and he was going to get ready to go home, though. The other thing that happened, there was another guy I took care of in that officer's ward. He was visualizing as he was in a sort of semi-coma. He was talking about the battle on Normandy. Well, he got shot. And he was losing spinal fluid. And when you lose spinal fluid, the doctor had always told me he doesn't have much longer to live. I got to talking to him. He told me he had a wife and a kid and that he's looking forward to going home. And I got to know him and it became so personal. And then he started going through this delirium. And then he would start talking. He would be talking very fast. Then he would start going like, oy, 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 okay, oy, 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 oy. All this gibberish. It was like nothing. And then finally, he died. Now, if a guy dies on your watch when you're taking care of him, I happen to be on duty when he died. This is the crazy thing, and I had to do it 4 times. You have to pack every cavity in his body with cotton. But it was not something I always talk about, but it was something that was just very traumatic for me. So you see, Paul, all these things just built up. So after I was there for a couple of months doing all of this and going through all of that thing and remembering and going through the flashbacks because I started getting them when I started sleeping, but I thought this is something they didn't know anything about post-traumatic stress. All they knew is they called it shell shock. I figured I had to live with it. And I figured when I get home, maybe it'll all be over. Now, I also thought, now that I got leave to go home for 30 days to see my family in New York, when I got the leave, I was wonderful, had a good time, and I thought, this is going to be better because I'm in a different atmosphere. Flashbacks kept going. It was scary. I said, if I go to the doctors, I thought they put me in a mental institution, honestly, what I was going through.
That's something Jack Gutman dealt with for decades before finally getting help. And he's written all about that process in his book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War.
I wanted to express what I was going through, the good and bad, and then let people know that they don't have to go through a war. They don't have to go through all the stuff I went through. People go through it with marriage problems and everything else. When I speak at some groups and their couples, I tell them this. We spend so much time thinking the grass is greener on the other side. But if you would water the grass you got, you'd be surprised how much greener it would get. So give love and you get love back. Pretend your spouse is like a cup. Fill it full of love, and all that overflows is yours.
Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story so candidly and for writing it down in this book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. It's one veteran's journey. It's your story.
Yeah.
But you know as well as I do, it's a parallel journey for so many veterans.
Absolutely.
And I get the sense that's another reason you wrote this book, to help them.
I plead to you veterans that are going through post-traumatic stress or any problem due to war or whatever it may be, get help.
Jack Gutman continues to proclaim that message far and wide at age 93. You can link to his book and full-length interviews with all the D-Day veterans you heard from today at hometownheroesradio.com. Next time, we're going to meet more Americans who were part of that monumental day nearly 75 years ago. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.